and it works.
Amy says she spends a lot of time tinkering with homemade contraptions that prevent neighborhood cats from ambushing her backyard birds and keep clever rodents from raiding the feeders, ensuring the safety of both the birds and mammals in her garden sanctuary.
So, you know, I've become very inventive as a result of my love of these birds and wanting to protect them.
BirdNote is on a mission to inspire a million people to take action to help birds by 2027. To learn more about what you can do to make a difference for birds, visit birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.
All right, welcome to Gardening with Embark. Joining me here in the studio is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society and our resident gardening expert.
Hi, good morning.
So, good morning. So we've spent the last couple of weeks, we're sort of in the middle, getting to the middle of the season, and we already have, you know, some of the crops we put in the ground coming up.
Correct, yeah.
And we're harvesting them, and we're also have some other plants that are sort of coming up that we'll be producing later in the summer that we need to think about. So we're busy with everything that's going on.
Yes. As you mentioned, the garden is very busy at the moment with lots of crops, garden beds full of vegetables. Harvesting, maintaining, watering.
But even with all that going on, we still need to be thinking ahead. We can't get caught up in the moment.
Correct. Correct. So here at Embark, we encourage to all our gardeners to garden year round. So they just don't focus on spring and summer, but let's go over the winter too. So at the moment, it's just the right time to start thinking what I would like to grow in the fall. Mm-hmm. Because as you mentioned, we are just so busy harvesting time, inching, keeping the garden wet, watered and weeded and mulched and all that. But let's stop a little while and think why I would like to grow over the fall. So at the moment, we have a good weather. So the soil is warm, lots of long days. Mm-hmm. So it's the time to select a section in the garden that is not full sun, but is in the shade or half shade. And that will be where we start our nursery. And particularly if we would like to have Brussels sprouts for Christmas, for winter break, now is the time to start our nursery where we come and start all Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, broccoli, overwintering cabbage, and as well the Walla Walla onions if we want to start from seeds. So this is the right time to start because the Walla Walla onions is a very nice vegetable that overwinters very nice. So we can keep it growing over the winter. So now, but they are very slow. They are very slow seeds. So we need to start right in these 2 weeks that we have. Yeah. So we can have a nice little seedlings by September to transplant when we harvest all our summer crops.
Excellent. So you mentioned about the plot should be sort of part sun, part shade. Why is that important?
Because it's important. Because we don't want to having to water constantly, so we want that the seedlings don't get too much sun when they are so young. Mm-hmm. So we just want them to get this good weather, but not to overexpose to the sun, and that as well, because when nurseries already need to be frequently watered. But if we put in the direct sun, we will almost watering every day. So we don't want to do that. Yeah. So keep the soil moist, but in a nice shady area. At the moment, even it's good because at the moment as well, we have to identify which area for our garden site has this kind of environment.
Right. Yeah. Continue.
Yeah. So here, for instance, in the learning garden, we have a garden bed underneath a tree. Mm-hmm. So this is our preferred area. So the sunlight just filters to the leaves of the tree and reach to the garden bed. And that garden bed is always moist. We don't have to worry about that. Oh, I forgot to water. And when we realize, oh, our plants are all suffering in stress. Yeah. So it's nice, keeps the soil moist, not much light. But again, it's nice and warm and the plants are just happy.
So it sounds like, you know, we're sort of going back to planting gardens, you know, because often, you know, people are focusing on things like tomatoes, which want lots and lots and lots of sun. But when you're planting your garden, putting your boxes out, it might be a good idea to sort of have some. Maybe you got one over in a different part of your garden or area that is like this with some shade.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So in our garden here, we have some boxes that are directly full sun. So every day get the sun. And the others are underneath trees. So they are in the shade. So those are our favorite boxes to start a nursery.
Right. So with these fall and winter plants, are we mainly talking starting from seeds here?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So we start from seeds, Walla Walla onions, Brussels sprouts. We can have cabbages, overwinter cabbages, broccoli, sprouting broccolinis. They are the mainly the main crops that we like for the fall. Now, we should remember that the vegetables that do very well in the fall are the same vegetables that do very well in the spring. Mm-hmm. However, when we start in the spring, the temperature goes from cold to hot.
Yeah, right.
On fall is the opposite. It goes from hot to cold, but the same type of vegetables. So if the vegetables can stand cold weather, they will stand the cold weather at the end of the season or the fall. So so peas very much starting in September. So by October, they are just in the right weather that they like it. But starting right now is for all those vegetables that take at least 8 weeks to germinate and turn into a nice seedling.
So that's quite a long time, 8 weeks. So we're gonna be putting things in the ground now,
yes,
and tending that ground with regular watering and stuff. But it's gonna be a little while before we start seeing shoots coming up.
Yes. So at the moment we will put the seeds and they germinate in 1 week. They should be up.
Okay.
And then we have to take care. Because at the moment, you know that there is slugs around, which love seedlings.
Yeah.
We have aphids around that as well like seedlings. So we have to take care of those little seedlings. And I overseed. So just counting that some of them are going to be eaten by the slugs.
Right. So are you out there every day looking for issues? Or how attentive do we need to be to these shoots?
Well, every time that we water the garden, we get in contact with our plants. I advise to do hand watering. So water with a watering wand, and you go and at the time touch new plants. If you are watering the soil, you will be removing, keeping your leaves around, collecting the plant, hiking the plant while you water around the soil.
Right.
So that's the way that we get in contact with the plants, and we can see, oh, there is aphids, there are ants, and why there are so many ants. And it's beautiful to see when there is a ladybug around.
Mm-hmm.
And slugs, usually they show up around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you gardening has troubles with the slugs, just show up around 5 o'clock, and then you will find them just coming out from their hiding, ready to start munching on the vegetables. There is two options. You pick them and dispose them in the composter or somewhere else, or you just find a way to get rid of the slugs. With aphids, very much I look for ants.
Mm-hmm.
When ants go up and down a plant, means that there are aphids, and I just follow the ants and they direct me where the aphids are. At the moment, we have two types that I have showing. We have the black ones, the black aphids, and the green aphids. They are the two ones I have seen in our gardens. And I keep an eye on the population. So if there is one plant that is sick, that's all right. And the nearby plants are all okay. They are not affected, so that's okay. And if it's a small population, I still use my hands to squish the aphids into the underneath the leaves. It's a squish, squish. I avoid doing strong spraying, jet spraying on the leaves. The leaves get damaged.
Right.
So I avoid that. because the leaves are the food factory of a plant. They through photosynthesis, they create sugars. So why to damage that? So I just prefer to squish them. So aphids, and if they're ladybugs, awesome. Now at the moment, ladybugs are laying eggs, which they turn into a small caterpillar, they will say, and that caterpillar will turn into another insect, look like a little crocodile, and then we turn into a ladybug. So we have to be very careful that we don't destroy the middle stage of the ladybug from egg to adult. So we have to be very careful that not by accident we just, oh, this is an insect, I'm gonna squish it.
Because they're your friends.
They're our friends, indeed.
So we're putting in seeds in the ground now. How long before we get towards the harvest?
Okay, so we put the seeds right now. So we have 1 week, they germinate. And from there, we count 7 more weeks, so which sends us almost at the beginning of September. And then the seedlings will be ready to transplant to their final stage. And from there, the transplanted week again count another 10 weeks.
Okay, so we're putting them out, germinating, getting them to a strong point. And then at the end of the summer, beginning of the fall, we're going to move them over to some of the places that our summer crops are finishing up.
Correct. So by the end of September, for instance, I tend to remove all my tomato plants.
Yeah.
Because there is no point to keep them longer. They should have been produced by then. All the tomatoes should have been, the green, red tomatoes being harvested, the green tomatoes can be harvested and mature indoors. So that space now becomes free and ready for welcoming new crops, the fall crops.
Excellent. Well, it's week 25, and that's these timelines that we're talking about here, and getting things done at the right time is why we're tracking it by these week numbers, because you need to be on time. So this this sounds really exciting for people who maybe focus on the summer as the obvious growing season, but you can really get things going and get some wonderful, wonderful harvests coming in the fall.
That's right. So we work by weekends, by weeks, I'm sorry, as keep track what's happening. So week 25, we start in the week 25. This weekend is the summer solstice, which is great. After that, we have to think, oh, the days are getting shorter and shorter. And then we have week 26, that is the, we must start our nursery by that time. So we have 2 weeks to play, to think what I'm going to plant, what I get my seeds, find the spot where I want to plant, prepare it. And then by week 26, by the end of week 26, we have started our nursery. And then we have the 10 weeks of school holidays, elementary, secondary school. So 10 weeks of holidays, 10 weeks for us to grow our nursery. When we return in September, the first, second week, we'll say, okay, which plants have ended producing? And we can start our fall garden in September. So, so it's very, very quick going. And then by September as well, we will start thinking, by week 36, we will start thinking on winterizing our garden. Because we had to know that by week 41, we will have the first frost. So it's, once we get September, things cool off very fast.
Yeah.
We don't want to get caught like, oh, I forgot to buy the plastic, I forgot to build my hoop house and all that.
Well, excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo. Everyone should be, if you want your fall crops, and you got some time, a little window right now to get things started, and you're going to have some plants ready to transfer in the fall and some nice harvests. Thanks so much for explaining all that to us today.
Well, happy to share our experiences here from the garden.
Thank you, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. How do people find out more about Embark?
Embark is located in the Student Union building in the ground floor. You can find us and our work at embarksustainability.org or through our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, see you next week.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine. equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
And now we have Peter R.H.'s regular segment. He's going to be joined by a couple guests today, Adam Tondowski and Stephen Fan. They're going to be talking about reserve currencies and just what that means in the international arena. Kind of an interesting discussion. It's going to be actually part of a sort of three-part discussion. Part one is today, talking about the BRICS and the emergence of the post-war consensus around the Bretton Woods Agreement and the post-war consensus around the international order. Here's that discussion. Hope you enjoy.
For example, I kind of see it for a lot of the African countries. Don't you think that it serves as a better alternative to the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund?
No. BRICS is basically controlled by China, their bank, and they're the same colonialists as the old colonialists.
But you're saying that mainland China's doing another form of colonialism.
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't you say they're getting a better deal, though?
I wouldn't say that. The Africans? I wouldn't say that.
But it just seems, in what way... But I think for the new development bank, which has comes forth from the forth from BRICS, which was started anyway, got a bit of okay, it doesn't matter anyway. So it came what it was 2012, I think it was formed, where BRICS kind of gets formulated 2009. It was a notion of an idea by some economic in the late 20th century, very late 1999. But don't you think it's offering some better alternatives to the... Well, talk about Africa, Central to South Africa.
Well, the African nations themselves say that the Chinese come up with very coercive agreements that has to use Chinese-made material. I think some of the employees have to be Chinese. I could be wrong about that, but I think the management and the Chinese extract what they want, and then they leave. And they say they leave all sorts of infrastructure behind. But the African countries, I think, themselves say that's mostly not true. That is... They exploit what they want, and then they go.
So you're saying it's even a worse deal than...
It's at least as bad, yeah.
At least as bad.
Yeah, it's as bad, at least as bad.
Or even worse.
Yeah, they're no panacea for Africa, that's for sure.
So you don't see the BRICS and was the new international interdeveloped bank being an alternative over in the future then?
No, I mean, maybe if they start competing with each other for Africa's attention, like happened during the Cold War, and that might be what some of these African nations want. I mean, I like to think that a lot of these better-run African nations are beyond sort of begging for exploitative international development, but, I mean... You know, that they would want to make deals on their own terms as best as they can, but nope, it's no alternative.
So, but you acknowledge that under the presidency of Robert McNamara, the World Bank, and also the International Monetary Fund became a twisted institution as such.
If you want to go back 50 years, yeah, I mean, I think that... obviously, the IMF bailouts, when countries were into receivership or whatever they were placed into, yeah, that was horrible. But I don't know how much McNamara was behind that. But yeah, the one-size-fits-all policy the Washington Consensus or neoliberalism, as they call it. That was pretty bad. But
as I like to say on the show, I always like to say what exactly the original meaning of the Washington Consensus was. It was that since the offices of the IMF, the Office of the World Bank, and the Federal Reserve of the United States were within blocks of each other, the concept is that both the World Bank and the IMF back up the American dollar.
Well, it was also that both the Democrats and the Republicans at the time were pretty much all in favor of the same policies in these areas. That was the consensus.
We have Stephen Fan coming in here, and I would like, and last week, Stephen Fan, we kind of concluded with the fact that because the United States currency is the world reserve currency, that it presents a situation that they will have a trade imbalance or whatever it is. So, Stephen, maybe take why do you think that having the United States currency as a reserve currency of the world would lead to United States having a trade imbalance with most of the countries in the world?
So this is not a new insight or an insight that I came up with. This came at the very beginning of the post-war global monetary system at Bretton Woods, which is a place in New Hampshire where the post-war economic order was essentially invented. And at that time, and it's kind of useful to know the genealogy of this, two competing proposals were debated. The first proposal was what eventually was adopted, although a little bit scaled back, which is Bretton Woods, with the U.S. dollar as the anchor, and initially the U.S. dollar being fixed at a certain exchange rate to gold. The second policy proposal, which was advocated by Lord Keynes, Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, a British economist, which was not adopted, was that they would have an international clearing union, and they would have a supranational, like a global currency, only used by the government to trade with each, deal with each other. This was not adopted, and the reason it was not adopted, it was complicated, but one of the things it was proposed in the first place was to address the issue of trade imbalance. The mechanics works a little bit like this. So the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world. The reserve currency of the world means that there needs to be enough U.S. dollars floating around outside of U.S. borders in the rest of the world, in places like China, in places like Canada, in places like Germany, to facilitate global economic activity and commerce and trade and investment. So there needs to be big stockpiles, essentially, of U.S. dollars outside of U.S. borders. We're talking like trillions of dollars, tens of trillions of dollars. Well, where do these U.S. dollars come from? Well, this is kind of conceptually, originally, the U.S. government prints them, but originally they were meant for U.S. domestic circulation. How it goes to the rest of the world is essentially through trade. Let's say I'm America and you're Canada, and I buy a bunch of stuff from you and you buy a bunch of stuff from me. Let's say I buy $100 billion from you and you only buy $90 billion from me. I'm America, you're Canada again. So there's a $10 billion trade deficit. Well, that trade deficit gets converted into the monetary balance that's outside of the United States. And that serves the purpose of the global reserve currency. So now, until now, we're considering how does trade, or to say a trade deficit, facilitate the use of a global reserve currency. But the process works in reverse. So if you have a situation as rapidly developed in the post-war economic boom across the Western economies in the 50s, 60s, and so forth, eventually the need for the reserve currency itself starts not just being compatible with trade deficits, but sustaining and creating and aggravating trade deficits. That is to say, the need for dollars, very literally, right? Let's say I'm a German merchant, what classic, Mittelstand German mid-sized export company that makes specialized industrial equipment, does really well in the aftermath of the Second World War and the Cold War economic boom. they export a whole bunch, and you know, because the U.S. dollar is the global currency, they invoice their exports in U.S. dollars. As a result, they have a bunch of U.S. dollars, and because the German exporters, the German manufacturer, they tend to be a little bit more conservative culturally. They hold on to their dollars. They don't spend all their dollars. They spend some of their dollars because they want new cars, which, well, I don't know if they're buying American cars. but maybe they want new Boeing airplanes. Maybe they want new things, new rockets, or just new things. And they can spend them, or new investment for their factories.
We're going to be running out of time. So if you can sort of
tie up
your ends there, because that's an awesome explanation of how the system works, but I can see that Adam here has got something to say.
Okay, yeah, just let me...
I have a few points, but anyway.
Yeah, let me wrap up. But the point is, there's a giant cash balance left over, and it grows over time. Well, that in itself becomes the trade deficit, because the German guy is not buying enough. Or, just putting it another way, America is not exporting enough. So that's how... Structurally speaking, having a global reserve currency causes persistent and meaningful trade deficits in the country that is the global monetary hegemon.
If I could just bring in 2 points. One thing is, in 1971, the United States chose to go off the gold standard.
Yes.
Now, that is going, some people would argue that's going counter to the argument that what was in 1944, it was on. To be always on the premise, the United States would be on the gold standard. So some people consider that the United States went foul in 1971. Go on, Adam.
That was known as Nixon shock or shaku, for those interested in the history.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting thing, the going off the gold standard. And this is kind of a separate layer problem on top of the existing problem with just having trade deficits and global reserve currency in general. But let me put it this way. It's a very simple answer to this. The global economy post-war, post-1945, was growing so fast that it outstripped any ability of the gold supply to function as a meaningful monetary standard. So that was inevitable. The way America managed it was ties into the way it's a monetary sovereign, and it doesn't really work and has all sorts of problems. But gold in and of itself was never going to work as a persistent global monetary standard in the modern world.
And I believe it was replaced by the U.S. dollar becoming the currency of trade for commodities, especially oil, but actually a whole bunch of commodities. But oil is the best known, the so-called petrodollar.
Yeah. What the petrodollar is... We may conclude on this remark, is that that's where every OPEC country, this is an agreement signed in 1974 in Saudi Arabia, every OPEC country can only accept American currency as payment for their petroleum. And that, so it's not really that oil is a currency, it's just that it sort of backs up the American dollar that was getting in a lot of trouble.
It functioned as a kind of replacement gold, right? It was kind of a black gold. And that's why the era from 1971, 1974 to, let's say, really around 2011 until the current American shale boom, in which case America doesn't really need foreign oil anymore, that's generally considered the petrodollar era. And since the 2010s, that's when American shale boom happened, and America became a net exporter rather than importer of oil.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m. Your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Beauty day, man. Let's take the boat out.
Sure. Toss me a life jack. Try that again. One more time. What about my shades?
1 in 3 fatalities on our waterways is caused by impaired boating. Make the smart choice. Don't boat impaired.
We really should stay on the dock.
A message from Mad Canada.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC, home of McFog the dog.